Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
With your top story as you wake up here in New York City and beyond, talks about talks. China will dispatch Vice Commerce Minister to the United States for low-level trade talks in late August, the first official exchanges since earlier negotiations broke down, I think about 2 months ago. Joining me to discuss is Dom Constant, Deutsche Bank Securities Managing Director and Global Head of Rates Research. Good morning to you, Dom.
Good morning.
Low-level talks, talks about talks, apparently. How excited should we be this morning?
Probably not that excited. I think there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing in terms of all these sort of talks and the whole kind of trade tension story. But I think fundamentally the question people should be asking themselves is this about getting concessions in the current trading regime to make trade freer and fairer type thing? And is the issue of China the similar issues with Mexico or Canada, etc.? Or is there something more fundamental here about changing the regime, changing the way in which we think about China as an economic competitor? Perhaps they've become too powerful relative to not just the US but other large economies such as Europe, and perhaps that needs to be changed from the perspective of either this administration or other countries. And I think that's a real issue.
Well, right now, Dom, the US economy looks rock solid. We just had Walmart numbers drop across the screen. Second quarter adjusted EPS 129, the estimate 122, the best sales in more than a decade from Walmart, and they've boosted their year adjusted EPS forecast as well. This is looking really good in the United States, whilst the rest of the world is looking a little bit more fragile relative to, say, 12 months ago.
Right, but on a sort of couple of decade basis, it's pretty amazing that most of our treasury market is owned by overseas countries, and it's pretty amazing that you've had such a huge reserve accumulation, particularly out of Asia. And I'm not saying, I don't think there's any right or wrong about this. I just think some of the concern is that the ability for that spending power in the world is something that is making some people think that is that kind of the right sort of balance of economic power going forward. And I think the idea about the trade discussions is a way of saying, look, perhaps we want to rebalance this a little bit. And if you can do it in a way that China can continue to grow very strongly, which is very good for them, and the US does very well, then in the end, it could be a better outcome for everyone on balance. But I think right now, that's where the issue is. I don't think it's directly about you're trading your soybeans or your cars, and it's just specifically about that. I think it's a bigger picture here, and that's why I think markets have to be careful that there isn't what is the nature of the regime shift. The nature of the regime shift is you enter a world where something like the renminbi, for example, does actually depreciate much more substantially. I've lived through a couple of China depreciations, and they are quite seismic events.
Yep.
That's kind of, I think, the question that some people in the markets are asking now is does this represent a regime change rather than just a question about sort of making trade a little bit freer and fairer?
Well, I can tell you this morning, the mood music in the market a whole lot better. Some warmth in the tape and the Chinese currency a little bit stronger. And Tom Keene, looking at Walmart right now, following those numbers, up by 6.5% in the pre-market.
Yeah. I want to give them great credit. Their release of their earnings is a lot clearer than it was 4 or 5 years ago. E-commerce sales grew, the headline, 40%. That's from a relatively low base, but that's where a lot of the pros are going to turn to, John, is to see how they're doing versus Amazon.
Yeah. Well, the stock is flying right now, but elsewhere, Dom, and I want your view on this. We've got a bear market in European banks. We've got a bear market in copper, and seemingly we're on course for a bear market in emerging market equities. I think it raises a big, big question for investors and beyond the United States. Just how immune is the US to all of this? What is happening in global markets right now? Just how immune is the United States to this?
Well, it's immune up to a point, but at the end of the day, the dollar, unfortunately, if it gets way too strong, will tighten financial conditions a lot. And then the immunity might still be there, but the onus is going to be on the central bank, the Fed, to basically not continue to raise rates, for example, at least take some kind of time out if the dollar gets too strong. At the end of the day, financial conditions overall become very important for the outlook for the U.S. We're still a trading country.
The dollar gets too strong. Frame that off DXY or broad trade weighted. I'll let you decide, Dominic Costum, but it's not Plaza Accord too strong. We're not looking at the silliness of the 1980s because there's a lot more fixed. It's a floating world. How much is too strong too strong?
Well, I think
a redux of what we saw 2 years ago, a nice leg up.
Too strong would become basically at the end of the day, you start looking at the inflation component in the U.S. economy. The inflation component has a third of it is in the goods sector. I would argue if the dollar were to go up, say, 10 or 20% on the trade weighted index, you're clearly going to have a lot of disinflation running through that goods side. And that would be... too strong, if you like, in the context of if you can't get inflation from the other parts of the economy.
Not only you, but your entire team led by Folkerts Landau. How do you frame the likelihood of the Fed shocking and not raising rates or adjusting their language versus what seems to be the almost certitude, the managed message that we're seeing now?
Very near term, I think the Fed is pretty much locked in to raising rates. They're not going to suddenly change.
Us out the next year when Walmart's up another 40%.
Well, it's gonna ultimately depend on how risk assets in the U.S. are performing. I mean, if you have an extremely strong dollar and the S&P starts to go down sort of 5, 10, 15%, then that's going to start changing the attitude towards the Fed, I'm pretty sure. And remember, I don't think the issue for them is, you know, they don't have to raise rates every single quarter. That is our view right now. Obviously, that's what we expect. But it doesn't mean that they couldn't, you know, start missing in meetings in order to be able to raise rates further. But so I think the issue for them is the path.
Let's be clear about the U.S. dollar and who's complaining about it. The Federal Reserve's not really complaining about the strength of the U.S. dollar. This administration is complaining about the strength of the U.S. dollar. And many analysts now on Wall Street and beyond starting to speculate as to whether we could get some direct intervention from the Treasury. Do you see that happening, Dom? And what kind of chances, odds, do you sort of apply to that happening?
I mean, I'd be shocked if they intervene. I mean, historically, obviously, it would be, you know, unprecedented, pretty much in the current circumstances for them to have any kind of intervention like that. So I think things would have to deteriorate a lot further to see that. I mean, and remember, the strength of the dollar is not absurdly strong versus the euro. It's not absurdly strong versus the yen. I mean, the strength that people are sort of raising is obviously the emerging market complex. An emerging market complex is kind of, if you like, perhaps feeling the brunt of the normalization of interest rates as well in the U.S.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more of that. So I think there are things that can happen to help stabilize the emerging markets that wouldn't necessarily involve FX intervention type thing.
Don Comston of Deutsche Bank, the securities managing director and global head of rates research. I'm pleased to say on Global Fixed Income, we're joined by Greg Parsons, Semper Capital Chief Executive Officer, getting AUM up to $3 billion and in growth. Great to see you, Greg. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Appreciate the chance.
Where do you want to begin with fixed income at the moment? Because when everyone else internationally seems to be afraid of what's happening with the macro backdrop, here in the United States, we're looking rock solid.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think you nailed it, right? Two things we think about, right? We are what we believe to be in a continued rising rate environment. So obviously within fixed income, that makes you think about where you want to be on the curve. But you've got a growing setup of continued strength in the U.S. and how and when that decouples, can that decouple from the kind of the rest of the markets?
Well, let's talk about decoupling, because high yield here in the United States seems to have decoupled from what's happening worldwide, whether you're looking at high yield in EM, high yield in, say, Europe. Can that continue, and can we continue to get this outperformance in the junkiest of junk in triple C's?
Look, you know, our perspective is, and you know, we are a bottoms-up kind of quantitative shop, right? From a data perspective, the data suggests that, you know, there's continued strength across, you know, U.S. credit, right? Whether it's asset-backed, mortgage-backed, within, you know, targeted portions of the high-yield market. And as long as, the data continues to show signs of strength, we believe that you can offset, you know, the impact of rising rates with some continued strong performance.
So the shorter duration explains why high-yield, say, has outperformed investment grade in the United States this year?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, look, duration is the 800-pound gorilla in the room within the entire fixed income market. So finding ways to be short on the curve and or find opportunities where the credit component can outdrive the duration aspect.
Greg, we're thrilled you're here. I've got two questions. One of them is off topic, but let's start with the one on topic. Abby Johnson at Fidelity has thrown in the towel on fees and fixed income. Active management fixed income has got to respond to that. Basically, folks, she's going to give out bond index funds for next to nothing. What does it say about fixed income in this low rate environment and the ability for the industry to keep going?
Look, as a smaller boutique shop, right, obviously very strong belief in the power of active management, right? You've got to find, you know, on the active management side, managers have got to find and prove the ability to drive some element of value through bond selection, sector rotation, subsector rotation.
I'm going to ask you a question now in the time that we've got, which is maybe the most important question of the day. You are living and breathing the only one I know who took the path of Robert Mueller. You went to Princeton and you served as a captain in the Marines. The people, you know, Garrett Graff's book on Mueller and the FBI is one of my books of the summer. When you see everything, and I don't need a political angle here, but when you see everything about Mueller, what is the casting character he has out of New Jersey and the Marines that he will use day to day? How do you respond to the uproar that you see over your compatriot?
Look, I can't speak for the man, but, you know, there was a calling to serve. The intrinsic values that the Marine Corps embeds and everyone that serves, I think, are...
What is that key value in the heat, the crucible that he's in right now?
The key value relative to where he is now is kind of, you know, integrity and a focus on mission, right? He is a focus on mission,
which dovetails with the FBI perfectly.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, look, there is a very clear, impartial, what needs to be done, what is the absolute mission, and in his particular case, you know, get to the truth in an impartial, unbiased way.
When they train that in the Marines, how do they train focus on mission?
Oh, from day one, accomplishment of mission, then welfare of Marines, right? Those are... and they do that consciously, right? You know, as I think back to my, you know, officer training, you know, screening, et cetera, from day one, accomplishment of mission is the standing guideline by which you're measured across every dimension of everything you do.
John, should we bring it back on topic?
Can we get back to fixed income?
Can I focus on mission? Are we going to clip coupons or are we going to get total return?
Go on, Greg.
Well, you know, I think there's portions of the fixed income market, for example, you know, Semper focuses on, primary focus on the real estate portion of the asset-backed market. I think there's the ability to do both.
Yeah.
Right? You can find strategies in market on a long-only, you know, daily liquid perspective where there's yields in the 4.5% to 5% range and, you know, duration of, you know, 1 to 2, right, relative to something like the Barclays Agg, which is running, let's call it yield 3.25, the duration of 6, maybe 7. There are opportunities and pockets within the fixed income landscape to drive through clipping of coupon and active management, circling back to your earlier comment, drive a total return.
Greg, I don't know how you did to get by with us this morning, but you did fantastic in my mind. Thank you for coming by to Crazy Town.
In every building, there is a treasured room. At the White House, someone suggests it's the Green Room. There are treasured rooms, perhaps the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican. At 82 Devonshire, long ago and far away in Boston, there was a treasured room. And it is a chart room, and across all of Global Wall Street worldwide, it was legendary. We're going to rip up the script with Uri and Timmer, forget about EM, forget about international economics, and talk about what he invented. For Mr. Timmer, invented without question the most famous technical analyst room, moment, place in the history of Wall Street. Ned Johnson interviewed you were your knees shaking and quaking? It would never happen with Miss Johnson, Abigail, but with Ned Johnson, what was it like to sit there and talk charts?
Well, good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me. By the way, I did not invent the chart room. That was Mr. Johnson's father, who was called Mr. Johnson.
Of course, and he was Mr. Johnson.
He was Mr. Johnson. And that was, you know, back then in the day, in the 60s and 70s, that was like the command center because that was pre-electronic chart. So the investment professionals at Fidelity would sit in a room and pore over charts and figure out, you know, where to go next. But yeah, so when I interviewed at Fidelity 23 years ago in 1995, I interviewed like probably 20 different people. But Ned was the last person, and he had veto because when you go into the chart room, as I was doing, he needs to personally approve everyone. So, but he was very congenial, very friendly. It was actually not like a high pressure type thing. Yeah. And we just talked markets the whole time.
You did not make Peter Lynch smart, but you certainly made him smarter. What did Mr. Lynch take away from technical analysis?
Well, Peter had a genius when, I mean, in many ways, of course, they're legendary. But when he was doing media interviews, he would always throw out a lot of statistics, and I learned from him because now I do a lot of media that if you have enough facts handy,
you can baffle anyone.
basically. So when Peter retired from the scene, he would still do a lot of media, and usually I would work with him a few days in advance and just kind of run all the stats by him, and then he would pick up whatever he thought was useful in his interviews.
To get theoretical, there was point and figure charts, which are very different in the 19th century, and then we found bar charts, and then all of us read John Maggie in the 1940s cover to cover. It was the Bible. Does that stuff still work now? Does trend work now in this time of electronic speed?
Yes, it does. So I grew up basically bar charting, always on a log scale, of course.
If the
history is
Pim Fox uses a log scale.
If the history is long enough and you're measuring growth of any kind, then you should use a semi-log scale. And so in our chart room, basically most of the charts are bar charts on a log scale. And so they still work. I mean, maybe they get noisier if too many people are crowding at above resistance or below support. Maybe you get false moves. But ultimately, the market behavior is a subset of human behavior. And so studying historical market behavior and cycles, I think, is a timeless practice.
I've been helpful with the CFA Institute. I think my dues are due now that I think about it. I better pay those. But I've been on some of their boards in that. And I've always told the good people in Charlottesville, there should be more technical analysis within the CFA curricula. Do the young Turks, the best and brightest that Ms. Johnson is hiring, do they want to use the fabled chart room, or is that just like, you know, as old news as the Sistine Chapel?
Well, the chart room in its physical form, obviously, is less used today than it was 10
and
or
folks,
20 years
ago. Let me say this, folks. When you went into the old chart room, it was magical. The lights were dimmed, and they were right in your face, and it was visceral.
Yeah.
It was like a Navy thing.
Yeah, and our chart rooms, and we've had several iterations, were like museum quality. Like Mr. Johnson would insist on the right lights.
And the right pins.
And and some of these charts are 30 feet long, and they're floor to ceiling. And one of them basically scans the entire history of the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P. And you can't really call that up on your screen. You can call up a snippet of
history. Be careful now. This is Bloomberg. Come on. Yeah. We can do log Dow back to 1905, I think.
But if you want to go on
a
daily chart and we're looking at a market bottom, let's say, for instance, and you want to see what did this look like, you know, Ned would go and he would just draw his finger across the 30-foot chart and say, you know what, this looks like 1974, or I'm just giving an example, or topping patterns. That's something you can't look up with an algorithm or on a screen.
The life changed for everybody with a guy at Yale named Ibbotson. And Ibbotson came out with what you've just described, a chart that shows percentage change or slope matters and such. If I graph, and I use this on television, folks, I'll put the chart out later for Bloomberg Radio across Twitter. If I take a Dow Ibbotson chart, long-term chart, and I take trend, we're not stupid overvalued now like March of 2000. How overvalued are we? on the Ibbotson trend.
So when I do the same thing. I have all the Ibbotson data back to 1926. It's mm-hmm. a great data set.
Yeah.
And what I've done is I've actually spliced some older data, which was not the Dow or the S&P, but another index. And you can go all the way back to 1871.
Yeah.
Bob Shiller has that data series as well.
Yeah. Bob Shiller was teaching at Yale at that time.
And when you run a linear regression through that kind of log scale or through this through mm-hmm. that line, you can perfectly see all the secular bull and bear markets. It's really a beautiful thing. And when you do a deviation from trend analysis, you can see that every secular bull market begins at about 50 percentage points below trend, and every secular bull market ends at 100% or so above trend. And in 2009, at that low, we were 50% below. And today, we are basically at the trend. So from a purely a total return perspective, we are not overvalued. We're actually on trend. Valuation as a price to earnings is, of course, a different story. And the Ibbotson data doesn't measure that. It just measures returns.
When we look at all this, and it's like eight ways to go here, Yuri and Timur, but I'll go to Walmart today, an extraordinary earnings, a stock up for a blue chip battleship, up huge. Is it as good as it gets? I'm not saying the gloom of go to cash, but you and I have to have respect for a boom economy and what could come after. How do you manage that for investment?
Yeah, so what I learned a long time ago was to start combining the technicals and the fundamentals.
Thank you. Ed Hyman, good morning.
And to me, that's really the
100% agree. John Murphy agrees.
I mean, you can look at a chart and say, well, the trend is up, and a portfolio manager will say, yeah, well, duh, you know, I can see that.
Yeah.
But if you can speak the language, the fundamental language, and relate it to maybe earnings or valuation or trends in monetary policy, et cetera, then I think you have the full skill set, and also add in quantitative. You know, if you look at a technical indicator, let's backtest it. Let's see if it actually works. And a lot of indicators,
you can do that on the Bloomberg.
A lot of indicators in isolation, they have a batting average of about a coin toss. And so you need to add in contextual elements mm-hmm. that paint the narrative of what's going on. And then your odds go maybe to 60-40 or maybe 70-30 if you're really lucky.
Right.
But the current, you know, backdrop is that the economy is booming.
Right.
Inflation is starting to run hot. We're approaching the late cycle.
And the Red Sox are playing 7-11 baseball.
Yeah, exactly. so we're approaching late cycle, but we're not there. So things are good. And the pressures that the markets are feeling from the Fed raising rates now 7 times, about to go 8 times, and maybe 10 or 11 times when it's all said and done, the pressures are not being felt in the U.S. market right now because earnings are booming, but they are felt, as we have seen all week long, in emerging markets, which are down 20% from their highs.
This has been wonderful. Yuri and Timur, thank you so much. With Fidelity, obviously working on global macro, but far more there, a window back to a truly important past for all of global Wall Street.
Well, still with us is Elsa Lignos of RBC Capital Markets. Elsa, I feel like over the last couple of months, the summer months, the probabilities of a no deal, of a crashing out, of a good deal, of a second referendum have all increased. So that means that, you know, the uncertainty has increased. What does it mean for your pound call?
So it's really difficult having a long-term call on sterling at the moment, and it's very difficult for a lot of investors positioning for the long term as well. You know, we've seen people get much more tactical in the way they trade sterling, and others actually say it's untradeable, I don't even want to touch it. So when it comes to the long term forecast for sterling, I think you've got to be cognizant that there are some very different scenarios. It's almost like a binary view.
Okay, when do you think that we'll get more of an idea of what the view will be? Is it December? Is it February? Or can it actually come September, October?
You know what? Even that's a very fluid concept. If you look at bookies markets at the moment, it's actually very interesting that the expectation for when Brexit is actually going to happen is not necessarily March 2019. There's actually a lot of people betting that it gets delayed by a few months or even by a year, or even some people thinking it doesn't happen at all. So there's clearly a lot of uncertainty both around outcome but also around timing.
Well, then that is your call on sterling. What is it?
So I think it's easier to focus on the short term, really, if you want to have any certainty or, if you're trying to trade it rather than picking out a number out of the air for a point forecast. I think at the moment, euro sterling looks fairly interesting. It's been in this rising uptrend, but it's actually one of our trades to watch. You know, we're getting to a stage where there's actually quite a lot of short term bad news priced in, a lot of pessimism around the potential outcome for negotiations. And there could be some downside there if you see a break of this rising uptrend.
That needs a deep market. Are the foreign exchange markets behaving with enough depth in August to make these trades effective, or do you just have to stand aside until the autumn months?
It's really interesting, your question, actually, because August traditionally is thought of as a very low volume month. And that's certainly true sometimes, but not always. Particularly when you see some big events happening, you can actually see a lot more volume going through the market. I do think for investors that got ahead of September and actually started positioning with 9 month or 1 year vol trades, they were actually right to do so because we've already seen vol move up quite significantly. A month ago, still fairly cheap, not the case anymore.
If you look at your different calls, Elsa, so you have an interesting call on euro. We just went through pound and, the difficulty in it. Your yen call is 112. How do we get there?
So yen, actually 125.
125.
Really, it's quite a long-term story. We mentioned it earlier, based around what the Fed is going to do and how Fed rate increases is actually going to drive the cost of hedging for Japanese investors. I think the Japanese side is interesting as well. You know, we've just passed the fifth birthday of Abenomics. It's really done nothing for the Japanese yen, and it's not very likely to lead to some fantastic growth scenario for Japan. So the Bank of Japan is on hold. It's really what banks in the rest of the world are doing that makes the difference.
But also, if I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, you had a big call on big figure moves in yen. Do you stand by that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you look at dollar-yen over the long term, it's much more likely to be driven by capital flows of domestic investors than the swings on risk on, risk off. You know, we've seen dollar-yen actually somewhat anesthetized to the short-term risk appetite. The correlation is still high, but the elasticity is a lot lower than it was. So I think you've got to be much more focused in the long term on those capital flows rather than these swings in risk sentiment.
Absolutely brilliant. Elsa Lingos, thank you so much with RBC Capital Markets, a walk through the foreign exchange space, and also, of course, on EM. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.